You're listening to Daily Paul Radio. Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. WGRR Digital.
She's got Moxie, and she knows how to use it. Your late night, highly caffeinated host, the one and only smoking artist, Allison Brigger.
And welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Allison Brigger Show here on Daily Paul Radio. We're going to get straight to our interview. Finally, he was sick the last time we had scheduled an interview with Mr. Patrick Byrne, CEO of Overstock.com. He's been on hold all throughout the entire news segment, so I will just bring him on. Mr. Patrick Byrne, thank you so
much. Allison.
Thank you so much for hanging on. I'm sorry, my mix board does not have a Q channel, so I could not speak to you. So I'm sorry you had to endure the entire news segment.
No worries at all. It's such an honor to be invited on your show.
Well, I am so excited to have you on. And one of the reasons is because my grandfather said, you know, you can always tell the difference between those who have principles and those who are just shilling. And from reading your biography, it is pretty obvious that you didn't just do this whole Bitcoin thing because you wanted to try to make some marketing noise, which you did succeed in. I really applaud your efforts on the naked short selling, on you taking on the establishment and repeatedly over these years taking them on.
You know, I didn't mean to get in all these fights with people. I just sort of was putting one foot in front of the other. But you do that, you come on people who just need someone to stand up to them. It's amazing. Of course, you folks know that.
Well, we try. And so what is the latest? It's a kind of a long timeline, and I only was able to get up to 2006. Is this still kind of ongoing, or where are you at this point?
On the naked short selling, it's a, you know, basically the way to think of it is as fractional reserve banking without a reserve requirement. And but as regards to shares of stock rather than banking. And there are all these loopholes in the settlement system. In 2008, the federal government finally tightened the loopholes marginally. They actually took great steps. The banking system came under this sort of a manipulative attack. Not to say they didn't deserve something, but they so the government stepped in and changed the rules, and then subsequently, sort of in late 2008, tightened up the rules about 50% of what we were suggesting should be done. And it's because they don't want to kill what is really a big cash cow for on Wall Street still.
Of course, yes, because, you know, to me, the whole notion of the phony regulatory state when it's stacked with, you know, all of the administrators of the SEC and GATA and the CFTC, when they're all stacked with, like, Goldman Sachs and Wall Street bankers, it's really, I don't know, it doesn't really give me a whole lot of confidence in the system.
Right. Economists have a word for it, right, or a phrase, regulatory capture. And Milton Friedman noted it back, well, Stigler, his friend, was first to write about it in the early 70s. If you go back to the first regulator, the Interstate Commerce Commission, which was regulating the railroads, the railroads figured out, well, just start offering these people jobs so they all understand that if they're good boys, as they regulate when they retire, after 15, 20 years, they can be directors in our companies and we'll pay them a lot. And so everyone got the message, and the regulator stopped really working to protect society and instead became a finger puppet of the industry they were supposed to be regulating. That's regulatory capture, and it certainly happened with Wall Street and Washington. Sadly, Washington, I think that really to some significant degree we've become an oligarchy where you have some very powerful moneyed elite who have come to dominate Washington, and Washington is afraid to stand up to them.
Absolutely, and despite them trying to attack Overstock.com, the statistics I have here says you guys brought in income of $14.7 million. Forbes named you one of the 9 best companies to work for. So kudos to you for being able to resist them and, in fact, just expand the company. It's really amazing.
Thank you. Actually, last year we did $1.3 billion and made, I think, $88 million GAAP, $65 million free cash flow. We have a great company. Goldman Sachs was the love to make. They claim that, well, we came under attack because we deserved it. And I always like to remind them that they had to take an $800 billion bailout, or else they would have gone the way of vaudeville and the Wild Buffalo. And
the candlestick makers.
And the candlestick makers and lots of things. And here we never took any government bailout, and we made it. And by all rights of capitalism and the market, they'd be nothing but a greasy spot right now.
Right on. Well, I'm gonna chalk up your core set of philosophical values to the fact that your father worked for the Lincoln National Insurance Company, and you at least spent some of your time as a Hoosier.
Well, I wasn't that indeed born in Fort Wayne, and my father was an actuary there at Lincoln Life, and I think part of it comes from being born in Indiana, and part of it comes from my father sort of raised me to have an actuary's point of view on the world, and so both of those have probably made me a little gritty.
Well, when I was first trying to get you to get onto the show, and I saw that you were from Fort Wayne and you were a Hoosier, I am a Hoosier, have still remain a Hoosier, and so that was awesome to know that a Hoosier such a, and I didn't even know you were a Hoosier. I mean, I don't remember hearing about your rise and what you have accomplished with Overstock.com is something promoted within the state, which is really, in my opinion, quite a shame.
Well, that's very kind. I left Indiana when I was about 2 or 3 and grew up around New England. But I have had reason to be back in Indiana a lot for the last 4 or 5 years. I'm the chairman of the Milton Rose Friedman Foundation for School Choice, which is based there in Indianapolis. So I'm back in Indiana a lot. And you had a terrific governor there for a while. I had dinner with a few times, a guy named Mitch Daniel. Did you guys support him?
You know, I did in 2004 until roundabout through to the end of his second term. I found out that he did some, accounting tricks and basically he saved us from a huge deficit when he came into office and took over for O'Bannon. But he basically kicked the can down the road for the next, maybe not Pence in his first term, but possibly Governor Pence will have to deal with a whole lot of issues financially in his second term.
Well, if he was perfect, he probably wouldn't be a politician. But he was a good guy.
Yes.
I quite liked him personally. And he really stood up for school vouchers. And the Friedman Foundation is sort of the leading intellectual force behind the movement for school vouchers. And it's a great honor to be associated with them. And the foundation is based there in Indiana. And Mitch Daniels let there and helped usher through the legislature probably the best school choice bill in the country. So he's always got my heart for that.
Yeah, absolutely. They have, and some of the school districts really have improved here in the state. I mean, just through the competitive force of vouchers alone, and they continually expand the voucher program each year. And there's some talk that we may crush Common Core in the next session of the General Assembly. They've cut away some more of Common Core this session, and we may crush it fully next session.
Wow. Great. From your lips to God's ear.
Yes, let us hope so. So I know we're going to be going into a break here shortly as I watch the clock, but you did have some news last week that I saw, and I can't really remember the figure on it. How much have you now processed, has Overstock.com processed in Bitcoin?
$1 million in Bitcoin, launched on January 9th. Got to $1 million. In fact, it was a few days ago, Monday, I think, and we put out a release where we, in fact, had been thinking this year we would do $3 to $5 million. We've now upped that to $10 to $15 million. Is our projection for
that's
the year.
That's your revised projections for the year.
For the Bitcoin part of our sales. Yeah, well, like I say, we'll do over a billion. We'll probably do a billion and a half-ish this year, but 10 to 15 million of it Bitcoin.
Well, that is tremendous. I remember when I first read the article that said you guys were going to do it, I believe it was, second quarter, and then you, locked a bunch of developers in a room over a weekend and decided, we'll just go ahead and do it now. Really,
right.
I mean, do you realize your position in this? You remind me of, only without all the baggage of Andrew Jackson, you remind me of the move that Jackson did by basically removing federal deposits from Biddle's Bank, which was the second central bank.
Right.
And you're helping us to end the Fed by not waiting on some magical legislation to pass for us to even get an audit. I mean, you must be applauded for what you're doing, because with each, now that I can buy tube socks to a car, which I always say on the show over at Overstock.com. I mean, those are real tangible transactions for real goods to don't involve the blood dollar, the war dollar. And that's just something to really be celebrated. Had you been looking at Bitcoin for a long time before you decided to take the company in this direction?
Well, I had kept an eye on it for about 2 years, but not really thought hard about it, other than to think once I saw that in November, the feds, if they didn't green light it, they decided not to red light it. I decided to go ahead, but as you said, I had sort of a lackadaisical commitment that sometime in the latter half of 2014, when we had resources free up, to go ahead and do it. And I mentioned that to a reporter on December 19th, and then because it just got life of its own. And by the 30th, I realized, well, let's just get it done. Let's not wait 9 months. But, you know, going back to the bigger point you just made, the great fun, or I'd say I've removed a lot of frustration in my life by realizing, don't worry about changing people's minds. I'm not going to try to change the minds of the central bankers or the legislators who could do what we want done. Rather, you have an alternative. If there's an alternative and it's better, it sort of has a life of its own.
Absolutely, it does. We are speaking with the CEO of Overstock.com, who has just surpassed $1 million in Bitcoin sales, Mr. Patrick Byrne. You're listening to the Allison Bricker Show here on Daily Paul Radio, and we'll be right back. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Allison Bricker Show here on Daily Paul Radio. I am speaking with the CEO of Overstock.com, Mr. Patrick Byrne. And before we went to the break, you started to kind of expound upon that we're offering an alternative, which goes back to your whole notion of you're a big supporter of the vouchers for school choice. And I think it is just, did you realize what an impact it would be did you see the larger picture? Because for me, ending the Fed has been, after doing countless hours of research on just the whole history of central banking in this country, did you realize what a move you were making by accepting this alternative currency that isn't really considered legal tender by the U.S. government?
I did indeed. I did indeed. I can't believe that we have a central bank. It's such bad institutional. Well, we at least should be open to the possibility that there's better institutional design than having a central bank. We didn't have one to 100 years ago. Central, you sound like you don't need to be convinced, so I'll stop there. But yes, I did notice.
Right on, yes, that we have a Hamiltonian institution that is plaguing the entire globe.
I saw Thomas Sowell asked about it, and he said, you know, we should get rid of it. And his interlocutor said, he was quite surprised, said, really, we should, what do we replace it with? And he said, look, the central bank's like a tumor. And when you cut out a tumor, you don't say, well, what do we replace it with? You just cut it out. That's what we have to do with the Federal Reserve. Milton Friedman in 1992 was in an interview with the Minneapolis Federal Reserve, the Journal of the Minneapolis Federal Reserve, and they asked him what's the most important problem facing America. And he said the most important issue facing America is how do we get rid of you, the Federal Reserve? First of all, it should never have been put in place in the first place, but now that we've had a 100-year track record, we can, I believe, any honest observer is going to see it causes far more harm than it does good. You know, its original mission of just having a lender of last resort, arguably, if you're going to go down the path of fractional reserve bank, you're going to have backgrounds and you probably do need a lender of last resort. But they have arrogated to themselves a much broader objective, and which so far they've been failing since about 1929.
Absolutely. Even if we give them the Great Depression as like sort of a preseason trial, they have been an abject failure. And I don't know if you've ever read Jeffrey Tucker's book, It's a Jetsons World. But I find it fascinating that between the collapse of the second bank in 1836 and the rise of the Federal Reserve in 1913 is this vast, unreported through any government school textbook, expansions of both the entrepreneurial and the middle class. And and how the middle class and the working people don't realize that raising the minimum wage is the new debate. And that they don't understand inflation, and that the bank is actually like their biggest enemy, is something that is really, really rather disappointing, I guess.
Well, they'll get the joke eventually. Reality has a way of happening. Yes, it, you know, we did have this wonderful 100-year history of expansion. We also, you know, one could argue, and for example, my friend Mr. Buffett likes to argue, well, the 20th century was also a wonderful era of, you know, economic expansion for the U.S. However, to that, I think the evidence is now clear. Not that Buffett is ever wrong on anything, but sometimes he's. I have different points of view. I think the evidence is now clear that the prosperity, that some significant fraction of the prosperity that we enjoyed for, say, the last 30 years, especially the last 20 years of the 20th century, in the last 10, were in some degree just borrowed from the future. They weren't real prosperity. And the same could not be said of the prosperity of the 100 years that preceded the creation of the central bank. The prosperity grew, and it wasn't by borrowing from the future.
Right, and especially since Nixon took us finally off of the gold standard, we've really been playing with nothing but monopoly money.
Right, nothing but. So if we're going to play with monopoly money, let's have it be a monopoly money that the U.S. government and no government can print. Let it be a monopoly money that's digital and that's limited in supply and mathematically certain to be limited in supply.
Absolutely. Limiting is an absolutely awesome factor of Bitcoin. Now, are you down in Austin for the Texas Bitcoin Conference? Are you speaking there?
I know I'm speaking at one coming up. Is that in Austin?
There was one. I believe it started today and it goes till tomorrow, or maybe it ended.
No, then that's not the one. I'm speaking at some other conference, a couple others this year. But no, is that the big one? I'm not really part of the Bitcoin community. I sort of know all this theory behind it, but, you know, I'm not sort of on the message board. I probably should be.
Well, yeah, you are definitely, you know, I mean, when you made the announcement and you decided to, forget the second quarter, we're doing it now. That was, I'm sure you have endeared yourself to a lot of people here in the Liberty Movement. So I remember hearing Eric Voorhees talk a little bit about you. And there was a statement that was supposedly made that said, you weren't really going to hold Bitcoin, that you just kind of wanted to go ahead and take it. But then Eric Voorhees had mentioned last week, it was on the Tom Woods show, on Daily Paul Radio, that you guys had kind of changed that whole notion and that you are indeed not immediately cashing out of Bitcoin.
Yes, we had a board meeting and talked about it thoroughly, and we've decided to accumulate 10% of our Bitcoin purchases. So as we get $10 million in purchases, we'll be accumulating $1 million in Bitcoin. Can't do more because, you know, we need to convert Bitcoin into dollars in order to pay the suppliers for the goods we're selling people. So we can't just accumulate all the Bitcoin we get until suppliers start being ready to take some Bitcoin. But we're going to encourage that, too. We're going to figure out a way where suppliers have a small incentive to get paid in Bitcoin.
That was my next question. Was, you know, do you have some sort of maybe like a discount or a better placement on the homepage or something? I wondered if you were going to try to convince the suppliers then in turn to kind of help create the network.
Or, yeah, maybe say, look, we'll pay you a day or two faster. Instead of paying you in 30 days, we'll pay you in 28 days if you take it in Bitcoin or something like that. I don't know. We'll figure something out later this year and do it, and thus encourage suppliers to start taking it. And at some point, we'll do the same with colleagues. I have 1,500 colleagues, and maybe we'll say, you know, look, we'll pay you your bonus of X in U.S. dollars, but 102% of X if you take Bitcoin, and thus start incentivizing people to plug into the network. That's very much just the ambition.
That is tremendous. Well, I got to tell you, I let my Amazon Prime membership lapse for the first time in 3 years because I'm going to begin shopping all the time over at Overstock.com because, I mean, I want to support companies that support the notion of individual liberty. And to me, this move telegraphs precisely that.
That's so nice to hear. In fact, we have a wonderful loyalty program called Club-O. I don't mean to make this sound like a commercial.
No, go ahead.
It's better than Amazon Prime. You pay $20 and you get free shipping and money back rewards on everything you buy. A minimum of 5%, some things as much as 25%, and even 40% cash back. You accumulate in your account. So it's been various outside parties, consulting groups, and published reports on this kind of stuff have called it the most generous loyalty program on the internet. So check out Club-O, and when you make that switch from The other guy.
The other guy, yes. Well, you guys have always been kind of cutting edge, right? I remember seeing you on, I believe it was the Fox Business Show years ago. Was this maybe 09 or 11? I don't remember the real year. But you guys were on the cutting edge then when they released the .co domains. You guys had gone out and had the shortest domain. Can you still access Overstock.com through the O.co?
You can indeed. It's a shortcut.
That's awesome. Well, I want to talk a little bit. Again, we're headed towards these news breaks. But I want to talk about, we were kind of, you know, you talked earlier about the bailout that Goldman Sachs had. And I want to get your thoughts and your feelings on this whole calamity over Mt. Gox going down, which to me demonstrates capitalism at its finest without a bailout. But do you have any plans? Are you worried currently because of the volatility over the last couple of weeks? And now we had a Bitcoin CEO, a young woman that was found, well, they're saying she committed suicide. Do you pay attention to any of this, or do you just kind of consider this par for the course for a new startup currency?
Well, I don't pay any attention to it. People are emailing me, and I'm looking at the headlines and stuff. I don't really care. To me, Bitcoin is Bitcoin. There's a bunch of companies springing into existence around Bitcoin, and some of them are going to be run by crooks. Some of them are going to be run by guys who get hacked. And, you know, every time a bank gets robbed, people say, oh, look, there's something wrong with the U.S. dollar. Look, that bank got robbed. Well, every time a company goes bankrupt or gets robbed in the Bitcoin ecosystem, it creates these news stories about why you should stay away from it, be afraid of it. Look, there was a guy dealing in arms in Bitcoin. Well, you know what? People deal in arms using the dollar, too. It doesn't
absolutely
make the
dollar. They do. I got to stop you there. We're headed right into the bottom of the hour break. We're talking with Patrick Byrne here on the Allison Bricker Show on Daily Paul Radio. We'll be right back after the news. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Allison Bricker Show. Thanks for hanging on over the bottom of the hour news. I know how much you all love Fox. We are speaking with Mr. Patrick Byrne, CEO of Overstock.com. Mr. Byrne, thank you as well for hanging on over the break. I know that was another long extension. I wanted to ask you, though, do you guys have plans for taking on any additional cryptocurrencies, or are you kind of just waiting to see how the market plays out?
Great question. We are waiting to see how it evolves, but I have sort of two general responses on that. One is, if there is, in this, I think there's going to be an enormous first mover advantage, which is to say Bitcoin. There are path dependencies and high switching costs. So another cryptocurrency would have to be a lot better than Bitcoin to catch up with it. And in addition, if it has features that Bitcoin doesn't have, my understanding of the open source community around Bitcoin is they would probably look at those features of any up-and-coming coin and sort of adopt them into Bitcoin, always keep it, you know, as good technically as anybody else's. And if they do, if another currency like Dogecoin or Litecoin this really does start to catch on like Bitcoin has, the people with whom we've integrated, say Coinbase, or you can integrate with BitPay, and there's Light and Coinapult and such, those companies, I think, will just start, they'll start taking Dogecoin and Litecoin too, so it really won't be any additional work for us. So it's really just as if people, you know, people are writing me saying, hey, would you please start taking Dogecoin or Litecoin? And that'll get us some momentum. And the real answer is they have to do it on their own. They have to do it on their own enough to the point that some of these Silicon Valley companies like Coinbase decide, well, that's got enough, that cryptocurrency has gotten enough traction that it's time we integrate and start accepting it.
What do you say to critics who say that the government is, and where do you stand on regulation? Do you think Bitcoin needs some form of government regulation? And what do you think that would do to Bitcoin?
Well, I think there is, I don't think they need to, I don't think they can regulate Bitcoin per se. I mean, they can make it illegal to trade in Bitcoin or something. What they could do, and even libertarians, the smaller libertarians that I run with, believe that government does have a role in preventing force and fraud. And to the extent there's an exchange that is saying, we'll take your money, and in exchange we will get Bitcoin and hold Bitcoin safely for you and stuff, it's something that is going to naturally attract fraudsters. And I think the government does have a role in saying in regulating them. But there's smart regulation and not smart regulation, but there should be certain transparency and capital ratios, preferably 100%. Preferably, they're just converting the dollars that actual people are giving them to convert to Bitcoin. So I think that, you know, there's some simple smart regulation will be called for, but there's nothing the government can really do about Bitcoin itself. They'd have to be trying to regulate the laws of mathematics. It's like King Canute, the Danish
king,
you know, who thought he could regulate the waves to keep the tide from coming in.
Exactly. Well, what about what do you think about this notion? Now Bitcoin came out of basically the small L community, a bunch of hackers, programmers, etc. Do you see a place for a possible Bitcoin version of the Underwriter Laboratories to provide some sort of audit to these exchanges or some form of seal of approval? Is that a potential free market regulation?
That would be a wonderful free market solution, that there would be something that the Bitcoin community probably sponsored that operated like, you know, the UL, Underwriters Laboratories, sponsored by the insurance companies. And they just said, we're not going to insure homes that have appliances that aren't UL certified. If the Bitcoin community, I mean, a beautiful free market solution would be just what you described. They would fund some entity whose job would then be to go off and examine the big exchanges and give a seal of approval or not. And, you know, it doesn't even have to be some rule that if you can't operate, if you don't get a seal of approval. It's just if you're a customer looking for a place to open a wallet, you would want to go to a place that had that seal of approval versus one like Mt. Gox, which evidently didn't take its security as seriously as it should have.
Right, especially when they had I have a screen capture of their wiki page that actually talks about the problem that eventually brought them down. So obviously they were well aware of the malleability issue since it was on their own wiki page, but did nothing to do with it. Yeah, and I personally, I don't purchase lamps that don't have the UL or electronics that don't have the UL seal. I mean, it seems to me that there should be some sort of free market that could spring up to make sure that there is open transparency and reserves are indeed kept on hand. So this type of Mt. Gox thing doesn't repeat itself.
Listen, that's such an interesting idea, Allison. I'd like to ask any of your listeners to in the community to let me know, maybe investigate it a bit, and let me know if there is anyone yet sort of seriously suggesting that. And if so, my email is patrick@overstock.com. Please send me something or get them to get in touch with me, because I'd like to. That's such a great idea. I'd like to promote it. And if there is no such entity, maybe somebody should be creating one.
You know, we've talked about this a lot over in the Daily Paul chat room, which is where Daily Paul Radio sprang the life from. And it really kind of stems from the notion there have been some issues with some Liberty Movement campaigns where funds have been stolen. And the idea really kind of just rolled out of that there should be a way to certify that if, you know, these money bombs are going off, that the money is being spent to where it is. And it just seems now that we've watched Mt. Gox just basically disappear and it looks like there was fraud, if the allegations prove to be true, there needs to be some sort of oversight. And I personally would like to see it just come from the free market.
Yeah, you know, seriously, if any of your – I'd love someone to get in touch with me, patrick@overstock.com. If anyone will get in touch with me that either knows of such an entity or would like to create one, and we could talk about funding and creating such an entity, because that would be a really worthwhile way, and also it would be a demonstration project to show the world how the free market can generate solutions that are actually in better regulatory institutions than the government can.
Absolutely, and there's no threat of violence. If, like you said, if you don't want the seal, you don't have to have the seal, but you probably will lose some customers.
Yeah, if you want, you can go keep your money in a bank that isn't FDI insured as well. Well, I don't know if you can anymore, but I don't know if there are anymore. But they, so leaving it to individual choice rather than mandates.
Right on. Now, you are so easy to talk to. I forget that you move in these circles with these CEOs of these big corporations. Do they have come up to you and ask you about, like, explain to me, are you like the Bitcoin teacher in that circle? Do they have a lot of questions? Do your peers and other business owners Do they still see it as kind of enigmatic and they don't understand, or what's the learning curve you've seen?
Yes, I do. Pretty much every meeting I have now with someone outside the company or lunch or anything, they bring up, hey, I'm learning about Bitcoin. Tell me about it. Tell me about your decision. Everybody wants. And what's interesting, it's across strata of society. It's amazing to me how you talk to a taxi cab driver in Los Angeles who barely speaks English, but you mention Bitcoin, and they'll have heard of Bitcoin. So it's got this instant worldwide recognition.
And do you yourself see a problem with the way that our debt, the U.S. debt, is trending? Does that factor in at all to your desire to look at Bitcoin?
Absolutely, it does.
And
absolutely,
do you think that's why the other business owners are as well, like, considering? I mean, it's never happened in history where a country has just endlessly printed money to the point where now we call it these fancy names of quantitative easing and really survived. So, I mean, to me, that's another kind of unreported reality of when you guys decided to take a cryptocurrency that – there must be in the business community at least some skepticism about the longevity of the dollar.
Well, it's funny you ask that. I've had deep misgivings about the financial system since the middle part of the last decade. And I actually think that we kind of got lucky in 2008. It could have been much worse. But I do think that really nothing fundamentally has been fixed. We've mostly just reinflated a bubble, and we're calling it a recovery, and that's getting harder and harder to do. And the numbers, you know, the dancing routine has
right.
To
it's the
flashy.
Weather now. It's the weather that's really hurting the economy. I mean, every report I read out of Washington seems to have another excuse for this pitiful. It is a pitiful recovery.
Right, and it's even that is probably overstated because, you know, if they show, say, nominal growth of 4% and they calculate inflation as being 1.5%, they say, when you subtract the GDP deflator from the nominal growth and you get the real growth, and they say, 2.5%. Well, I think that they're probably dramatically understating inflation. If inflation were calculated like it was in the early 80s, if it were still calculated that way, it'd be running at 6% now. So, and they make these changes every few years, and it's not just the
Was that during the Clinton years where they took out fuel and food out of the inflation calculation?
As being too volatile. However, it is too volatile month to month. It introduces too much noise into the numbers. But year over year, it's quite meaningful, and they leave that out. So that's silly. And recently they adopted a substitution principle so that if the price of sirloin gets more expensive, they just assume that everybody switches to hamburger, and that way they don't record that inflation. So their inflation numbers are understated. But so, for example, if inflation really is running at 6%, there's a lot of anecdotal evidence that it is, and other ways of calculating it to suggest that, then you take that from the 4% and would say we're really in a minus 2%. So it's not that's why the recovery doesn't feel like much of a recovery. It may actually be we're really shrinking 1% or 2% and we're playing some games with the statistics. That's a big possibility. So why did you ask me about? Oh, so if that leads to, you know, there are some scenarios, and I use the metaphor zombies walk the earth. Obviously, some dumb people pretend not to understand metaphors. Things could get quite bad. I think we could easily have a 2008 again. I think we could have some 1929 again, maybe something in between. It's conceivable our society is not nearly as robust as it was in 1929. Now the average food that you eat comes from 1,500 miles away, brought in trucks that run diesel fuel and such. So we have a much more frangible, fragile society. So there are, even if the earthquake were of a magnitude no greater than the 1929, the effects could be much, much greater. So for all those reasons, yeah, I used to think I was a little worried. Well, I was a little worried about myself, about how much I worried about the fragility of the U.S. financial system. But really, in the last few years, everyone I meet that I can have that kind of conversation with, distant friends, distant acquaintances, when we have everybody's thinking of the same thing, can this really hold together, or do we reach some sort of are architectonic forces building underneath it all that someday are going to break loose and we're going to have a really bad situation? And if we do, Bitcoin, the more people who are integrated into Bitcoin at that point, the less your life is going to be disturbed. You're still going to be paid. You can still buy things and so forth. So that's another part of my thinking is if we integrate, even only if 1% of our business is in Bitcoin, and we can get 1% of our suppliers to accept Bitcoin and start paying 1% of our employees are getting 1% of their pay in Bitcoin, et cetera, you're at least getting a much more robust network that should there be something tragic happen with the dollar or with the U.S. government's fiscal situation, which are all probably all happens together, there's great uncertainty spreads across the system, as happened in 2008. To the extent you're plugged into Bitcoin and can shift to Bitcoin, and you're already plugged into Bitcoin and not, you know, one of millions lining up at the gates that day, but if you're already plugged in and with it, then maybe you can absorb, maybe our society can absorb more of a shock.
Well, that's an interesting take on the situation, and it was well explained. I wonder if do you think at all that the volatility in the pricing of Bitcoin is somewhat a reflection? Because I meet a lot of people who are very dollar centric, and they don't think that there's any other currency in the world outside of the U.S. dollar. Do you think the reason that Bitcoin shot up so far, so quickly, that some of that volatility is based on skepticism of the dollar itself?
Yes, and it should be noticed that some of Bitcoin's early boost came from, like, when Cyprus Financial System, Chernobyl, and they did a bail-in. I think everybody found out one day that for every $100 or drachma or whatever they used there that they had in the bank, they had 30 had been taken away from them or something. So a lot of people started converting into Bitcoin then. And by the way, the next time the banking system here starts sizzling, they're not going to do – they can't do the bailout. They know the same bailout. They know there would be sort of mass civil unrest. So I think that they will do a bail-in, which is when they just go to the depositors and take a fraction of their deposits, and that's how they recapitalize the bank. Well, what that happened in Cyprus is when a bunch of shopkeepers and folks went out and converted their money into Bitcoin. So that happens. That has happened, I think, in Greece as well. So that's, I look at Greece and I think, coming soon to a theater near you, probably a California theater near you. We are so fiscally – Warren Buffett put out his annual letter a few days ago, and in it he talks about basically the great – we're going to be dealing for a decade, and I think he was being optimistic that we're going to be dealing for a decade with just the pension, the underfunding of pensions, government pensions, which is really a lot of what's bankrupting California towns like Vallejo and Detroit, Michigan, and such. That's coming to us on a national level. And anyway, I hate to sound so...
No. That's fine. Now, you mentioned California. So do you support what Ted Draper is doing? Do you think that breaking California up would be a proper way to go? Or do you support this Jefferson Republic movement that is actually voting? Siskiyou County, California will be voting this June to form not the 51st state, but to form a sovereign territory. Do you support those kind of initiatives?
I'd like to think that we can fix these problems without redrawing the map of the United States. There are ways that I think if the federal government doesn't get its act together, it's going to find itself, there's going to be 50 sovereign states. There are in a number of states legitimate movements that wish to secede. I don't support any of that. I think that we should change our institutions within the Constitution of the United States and keep it together. But the federal government, I sometimes wonder how asleep at the switch are they? That, anyway.
Well, yeah, I don't know how asleep at the switch they are, but they sure seem to love this more and more wars and the hypocrisy expressed by John Kerry over the whole, not that I support what Russia did at all, but I mean, I can't believe the gall that some of the, like, where have they been? Does John Kerry not remember his vote for Iraq? So yeah, they do seem rather befuddled. Maybe that's where most of the zombies are inside of the federal government.
And I think the banks.
Yes.
But yeah, I think that, unfortunately the selection process for politicians isn't nearly what it should be. You think of other jobs. If somebody's, you know, works on a factory floor and they're welding bumpers onto cars, and eventually they're supervising six folks welding bumpers onto cars, they're forming theories about the world, and the world gives them feedback about whether they were right or not. And the same is true if you're, you know, working in a toothpaste factory, if you're a dentist, if you build bridges, if you're a business executive, you're forming theories about the world, and the world tells you when you're right or wrong, and if you keep your eyes open, you get smarter. And physicians, I'd say, fall in the same camp, but politicians can go through their whole life just saying the silliest stuff, and whatever happens, they can always blame everything on something else or spin what they said earlier, as we've seen quite a bit of, and so they never get any smarter, and they just seem like silly people. So I would say that Kerry looks like a silly man to me.
Absolutely. So what is then, what's next for Overstock.com? Do you have, are you going to be delivering locally? Are you keeping your eye on the whole like drone delivery mechanisms? Are you guys expanding or looking into those fields as well?
Well, I think when that comes, it'll come with UPS and FedEx. You know, I think Amazon has made some promises about its supply chain that hasn't delivered on before. Although they're very good on supply chain, they found out, for example, it's a lot harder to do same-day delivery than they had anticipated, and sort of have scaled back expectations. I think that the drone program probably has gotten ahead of itself in terms of it's well off before there'd be something like that. I think at least 10 years, maybe 7 years, 10 years. So I don't think that is, and if it starts happening, FedEx and UPS are going to have it at the same time or earlier than Amazon.
Well, that's an awesome answer. Yeah, I didn't even consider that. I remember just seeing Bezos talk about his drone program, and yeah, duh. Again, they've got the infrastructure for logistically speaking. Then, yeah, UPS and FedEx could jump on it and master it much quicker.
And then we'll be, we just do business with FedEx and UPS. So we'll have it if they have it, but I'm not holding my breath.
Right on. So, Mr. Byrne, do you write a lot? Is there a blog over at Overstock.com? How do people follow you? Are you on Twitter, Facebook? What's your preferred method of interacting?
Oddly, I've never been on Facebook or Twitter. I don't. Or LinkedIn. I once signed up on LinkedIn. I started getting flooded 500 times a day, and it's a drag. So I don't do those. I do write a blog at Deep Capture, it's called. It's a reference to regulatory capture that goes so deep. It's called Deep Capture. And that's where I've addressed a lot of my thoughts about Wall Street and the federal government in the past.
Excellent.
And if you go on YouTube and Google and YouTube my name, search for my name, you'll see a whole bunch of videos and TV appearances.
Awesome. Now, you said you had I will post this interview over at dailypaulradio.com, and I'll send it to your assistant for a link so you can link to it if you'd like. You said you were going to be speaking at a conference, and when is that engagement coming up?
I don't know off the top of my head. I think I'm speaking at Cato. You mentioned Jeffrey Tucker. I think I'm speaking at Cato in October.
Awesome. Well, Mr. Byrne, thank you so much for coming on the Allison Bricker Show. It has been a pleasure to speak with you. I hope we get a chance to speak again here, and much continued success pushing back against the system and, of course, Overstock.com.
Allison, I would love to. I would love to anytime you want, but on one condition only.
Sure.
And that is that you start calling me Patrick.
Okay. That's okay. Not a problem. I always defer to, what do they call those, the titles.
The honorifics.
Right on. Well, again, thank you so much, Patrick, and I look forward to having you back on the show.
Right on, Allison. Bye-bye.
Take care. There you have it, ladies and gentlemen. That was my interview with Patrick Byrne, CEO of Overstock.com. Amazing.
You're listening to Daily Paul Radio, revolutionary talk for revolutionary times, WGRR Digital.